I saw one of you at supper tonight, and you had missed last week, and you said it was really hard going trying to get through Leviticus. Those of you who were here last week, I hope it's a little easier for you to get through Leviticus after what we did last week. I hope that's true. Numbers may be just as hard, and so may some other things. And so tonight my hope is to lay out for you some of the things to watch for and listen for in these sections. I've learned to check this each month, and I'm going to try to continue to do that. My schedule says that you all are going to be reading Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua in the next month. So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. If I'm wrong, you can correct me later, because I'm not ready to talk about anything else. And before I start, I want to take just a moment and give you a tiny little orientation to the Old Testament. The answers to these questions, a few of you will know where this is going, the answers to these questions are going to be 5 or 12. The answers to these questions are going to be 5 or 12. There are in the Old Testament books that we call the books of the law. How many books? Five. They're followed by books of history. Joshua is the first of the books of history. Deuteronomy is the last of the books of the law. How many books of history are there? 12. Those are followed by books of wisdom. Psalms and Proverbs is an example. Job is one of those. We've already looked largely at Job. How many books of wisdom or wisdom literature is there? Five. That's followed by the prophets. How many books of prophets are there? Five. Plus 12. The first 5 are called major prophets. The last 12 are called minor prophets. Why are minor prophets called minor prophets? Because the books are short. Why are major prophets called major prophets? Because the books are long. Are there major prophets among the minor prophets? You bet. Are there major prophets that don't get a book at all? You bet. Elijah and Elisha come to mind in that latter category. That's the layout of the Old Testament, and that may help you a little bit as you're oriented to this. We come tonight to Numbers. That's the fourth of the books of the law. Numbers and Deuteronomy will finish that. Joshua will start the next. You will see there's a nice, easy, direct transition from Deuteronomy into Joshua. Why is it called Numbers? That was a rhetorical question. That means I get the answer. It's called Numbers because it starts with a census. We're about to have a census. Why do you have a census? Answer, to figure out how many people there are. Why would you want to know how many people there are? Answer, you might want to go to war. You might want to levy taxes. You might want to set budgets. You might want to know how many people there are. God said something real interesting, and you need to watch for this. God said, don't take censuses. Don't take it. And if you ever decide you have to take a census, every single person who is counted needs to make an offering to the Lord to redeem himself from the awful things that happen when you take a census and I didn't tell you to take it. And you start walking through the Bible, and all of a sudden you get over to where David is, and David takes a census because he's trying to figure out how many soldiers he has. And God says, you're not supposed to worry about how many soldiers you have. You're supposed to be depending on me for your safety. And a plague broke out, just like God said in Numbers was going to happen. And the things that happened around that plague of David are connected back to some of the things you'll read in Numbers about the census. But they did take a census. In fact, they took two. There's one early on, verse 2 of chapter 1. God said to Moses, take a census of the whole community of Israelites. You and Aaron, verse 3, will register all those in Israel, 20 years or age and over, fit to bear arms, company by company. You'll have a man from each tribe, the head of his family, to help you. You're going to count them. Okay? Why did God tell him to take that census? Answer is, not clear. Not until you get over to very late in this process, over to, I think it's Numbers 32. They take a second census. God says, take a second census. They take a census. Okay? So the book of Numbers has these two times when they are numbering the people. And it's called Numbers for that reason. As the night goes on, my plan is to bring you to where you understand why there were two censuses taken. But it's too early for me to tell you that. Okay? Now, when they take a census, it's real interesting, they don't count Levi. Not until later. They count Levi later. When they start, they just count the 12 tribes. Wait a minute, I thought Levi was one of the 12 tribes. Well, he is. But they don't count him. So how do you still get 12? They took Joseph and gave him a double. And so if you watch through the book of Numbers and through Deuteronomy, you will occasionally hear the tribes that come from Joseph. There's two of them, Manasseh and Ephraim. You will hear them referred to as the half-tribe of Manasseh, the half-tribe of Ephraim. And those are named back to the sons of Joseph. Joseph, because of all he did to save his people during the time of the famine, when they originally came into Egypt, Joseph was given a double tribe. Why is Levi taken out? Because Levi's descendants are the ones who lead in worship. All the priests are from the tribe of Levi. Moses and Aaron are both from the tribe of Levi. Aaron's children are the ones who become the priests. If you're going to be a priest in ancient Israel, you were a son of Aaron in the tribe of Levi. And so the ones who lead in worship, they actually count them at another place. So there's actually one census. They count everybody who isn't Levi. And then a little bit later, they count the ones that are Levi. Then they take the second census later on, much in the same way. A lot of this is given over to that piece. So you're going to have a lot of counting. Slog your way through there. It's okay. But that's what they're doing. And there's a reason there's two censuses, but I'm not going to tell you yet. We're going to look at something else. Numbers chapter 7. Thank you for the page rustling. That means you're looking this up, and I appreciate you doing that. I want you to look at the tail end of Numbers 6, just as long as we're wandering through here. Verse 22, in Numbers chapter 6. It's the last little bit of chapter 6. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, "Speak to Aaron and his sons." Who are Aaron and his sons? They're the priests. "And say, this is how you must bless the Israelites. This is what you will say. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord let his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord show you his face and bring you peace." One of the greatest blessings that's ever been said in the Bible. And it's just kind of hanging out. Middle of all the census, here it is. Let's go to number 7. First question, how many verses? How many verses in chapter 7? You have to thumb a page or two, because you're not going to find out on the first page. You may not find out on the second or third. 88, 89? 89 verses. There's a couple of chapters that are longer, but there's not many. This is an extremely long chapter. Let's begin. Verse 1, chapter 7. On the day that Moses finished erecting the dwelling, my translation says dwelling, yours probably says tabernacle. Okay, this was going to be the portable, mobile house of God. And it would not become permanent until Solomon built the temple much, much later. When Moses finished erecting the dwelling, back in Exodus and back in Leviticus, we saw lots of instructions on how that was to be built. Had to slog through that. But there's a lot in there, actually. That on the day Moses finished erecting the dwelling, the tabernacle, he anointed and consecrated it and all its furniture, as well as the altar and all its equipment. When he had anointed and consecrated it all, the leaders of Israel made an offering. These were the heads of families, the tribal leaders who had helped with the census. Remember, there was going to be one person from each tribe. Those same ones came forward with them. And from verse 3 to verse 9, it tells the offering that they brought. What were they dedicating? What was their offering in gratitude for? The construction of the tabernacle and all of its furnishings. Right? How long did it take for that? 6 verses. So far, okay? Where's the heart of worship? For these people, where's the heart of worship? It would be the tabernacle, wouldn't it? How many verses did it take to dedicate it? 6. Verse 10. The leaders then made an offering for what? for the dedication of the altar on the day it was anointed. They brought offerings before the altar, and the Lord said to Moses, each day one of the leaders must bring his offering for the dedication of the altar. Verse 12, on the first day an offering was brought by, and it names the same fellow who was named in the census help in the earlier part, of the tribe of Judah. His offering consisted of, and it starts to make a list of this, and this goes on through verse 17. Do you see that?
Yes, sir.
Tell me what's in verse 18 in summary. This is the second day. Second day. A different person, a different tribe. What's the offering? Exactly the same. Verse 24. What's this? Anybody see a pattern yet? How long is this going to go on? This is going to go on through verse 83. How long did it take to dedicate, to record the dedication of the tabernacle and of all the things in there? Six verses. How long did it take to talk about the dedication of the altar? 78 verses. What do we see in those 78 verses? We see identical gifts brought representing each of the tribes. Detail that isn't present. Why? What's going on here? I don't know this guy, but there's a guy named Phil Rosenblum, and he wrote a book some time back called How to Enjoy the Boring Parts of the Bible. Somebody saw this book, thought I would enjoy it, bought it, gave it to me. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it so much, I bought two more copies, put one copy in the church library, kept the other copy on my shelf so that when I lend one out, I'm not lending the only one I have. He calls this chapter the King of the Boring Parts. And then he says this, what are they dedicating in those 78 verses? Why does it take so long? And the answer is this. They're dedicating the altar. What happens on the altar? Sacrifice is made. On what altar was the greatest sacrifice ever made? On the cross. When was the cross dedicated? Here. By dedicating this physical, earthly symbol. The dedication of the cross is happening way back here in the Old Testament. Does that give you a different look at number 7? I think Phil Rosenblum has a point. Why are the gifts identical? At the foot of the cross, everybody's the same. And everybody's welcome. The whole of the nation is represented. Is that enough to get you going through that long chapter? No. There's more. There's big more. Turn back to Exodus 25, verse 22. Exodus 25, verse 22. In verse 17 of Exodus 25, God said to Moses, you will make a mercy seat of pure gold. And it tells him what to do with it. To end up after making it, putting it on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And he says in verse 21, you put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and inside the ark you will put the testimony which I'm about to give you. And verse 22, it says, there I will come to meet you from above the mercy seat, from between the two winged creatures which are on the ark of the testimony. There I will give you my orders for the Israelites. God and man speaking face to face. Where? At the mercy seat. Number 7. Verse 89. Verse 88 is the last of the summary of all the gifts that have been given. Verse 88 is followed by verse 89. Verse 89, the dedication of the altar has been made. Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, and he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony from between the two winged creatures. The fulfillment of the promise in Exodus 25:22 is at the end of this chapter, when they have recognized that the heart of worship is the sacrifice. And the sacrifice is made and the blood is applied. Then the door is open for God to commune with man. and that door has been shut since Adam and Eve sinned in the garden. There to my heart was the blood applied. Glory to his name. The old hymn ends. Number 7 is one of the more powerful chapters in the Old Testament, and I want to make sure you know that. Chapter 8, verse 2, he talks about lampstands and 7 lamps. Keep an eye on that, because way over in Revelation, as we enter the last book of the Bible, lampstands are going to figure in Revelation 1 and Revelation 2. There's echoes already here of things that are coming. Doing okay so far? Numbers 11. Numbers 11 begins with the people complaining. Do you see that in verse 1? And for the first time, or maybe the second time, Moses gets tired. He just gets tired. What are they complaining about? They're hungry. They want meat to eat. They've had manna for a while, but they want meat to eat. And over in verse 13, Moses is speaking to God. You ever want to know if it's okay to complain to God? Come to this section and read what Moses did. Moses says to God in verse 13, "Where am I supposed to find meat enough to feed all these people? These people pestering me with their tears and saying, 'Give me meat to eat.' I cannot carry all these people on my own. The weight is too much for me." Verse 16, the Lord says to Moses, "Collect me 70 of the elders of Israel, men you know to be the people's elders and scribes. Bring them to the tent of meeting. Let them stand beside you there. I'll come down and talk to you there, and I'll take some of the spirit which is on you and put it on them. There they will bear the burden of the people with you, and you'll no longer have to bear it all on your own." God says leadership is tough, and it ought to be delegated and shared. We ought to help our leaders. Now, it's interesting. Part of what he says is, "I'm going to put his spirit on them." You know what happens when God's spirit comes on you in these days? Maybe it still does. You start to prophesy. What does prophesy mean? It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to tell what the future is. What it means is, I'm going to start to speak in God's name. I'm going to start to speak, or I'm going to start to teach. I'm going to do something that begins to proclaim God's grace and God's glory to God's people. That's what prophesying means more than almost anything, I think. Okay? So that's what he says. Come down to verse 24. Moses went out, told people what God had said. He collected 70 of the people's elders, put them around the tent. The Lord descended in the cloud, spoke to Moses, took some of the spirit that was on Moses, put it on the 70 elders, and when the spirit came on them, they prophesied. And my Bible has a little bit of a tag to that. Does yours? But only once. It happened once. They got to experience some of what Moses was experiencing. Right? Next verse is when it gets interesting. Two men had stayed back in the camp, and he names the two. I like Eldad and Medad. Me granddad in these days, but I don't know that that's what it means. The Spirit came down on them, though they had not gone to the tent. Their names were enrolled among the rest. I have this picture that there's 68 people up there. There's supposed to be 70. Two of them had lagged behind for some reason. The Spirit comes on the 68, also comes on the two over here. A young man ran to tell Moses. "Look," he says, "Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp." Who was this young man? It tells you. That's who we're going to read about in the book of Joshua. This is coming. Joshua, son of Nun, who had served Moses since he was a boy, spoke up and said, "My Lord Moses, stop them." And Moses replied, "Are you jealous on my account? If only all of God's people had God's spirit and were prophets, and the Lord had put on them his spirit." What came at Pentecost? What's promised to every believer today? God's spirit is on us. If we don't speak, it's not because the spirit hasn't come to us. If only all of God's people were prophets and the Lord had given all of them his spirit. Powerful little verse. Don't miss that as you go by. You're going to look for these things later, right? Okay. The next verse or two, the meat comes in the form of quails. If you like quail, this is a good verse. Okay. Numbers 13, I'm going to give you a summary. Numbers 13, Moses says to the people, okay, enough time has gone by. It's time for us to go into the promised land. It's been a year or two. That's all. It's only been a year or two. And he says, it's time. But before we go, we're going to send some people into the land. They're referred to in my translation as spies. We're going to send some people into the land, and they're going to look at the land and try to figure out what the right way is for us to enter and take over. And they name the ones who went, and among the ones who went, they name Caleb in verse 6, and they name Joshua in verse 8. Okay? When the 12 come back, 10 of them say, there is no way on earth we're going to take this country. Those people are too big, the cities are too well fortified, it's a great place, but there's no way we're going to do that. And 2 of them said, of course we can do it. God is with us. Who did the people listen to? They listened to the 10. And they said, what have you done bringing us out here in the wilderness? We should go back to Egypt. Verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1. The whole community cried out in dismay, and the people wept all that night. Would to God that we had died in Egypt, or that we had died in this desert. Why has God brought us to this country for us to perish by the sword, and our wives and children be taken as booty? Keep an eye on that verse. Keep an eye on that verse. And they said to one another in verse 4, let's get a different leader and go back to Egypt. Now, here's the key. What did God say to those people through Moses? Go and figure out how to take the land. When the 10 came back, what was their report? We can't. They weren't asked, can we or can't we? They were asked, go figure out how. Joshua and Caleb were the only two that did. This is the rebellion that cost them another 38 years in the wilderness. Because what God said was, okay, you have rebelled, and you're going to wander in the wilderness until every one of you dies off. And those children that you were so afraid of getting caught up as booty, they're the ones that will take the promised land. Why did they take a second census? To make sure that all of those had died. The second sentence, when you get to the second census, it tells you, and not a name was found in that census that was found in the first census, except for Caleb and Joshua. Getting more interesting? Okay. Interestingly enough, in the middle of this is still in chapter 14. You can find out where when you read through. In the middle of chapter 14, God says to Moses, okay, look, I think I've about had it with these people. I don't know exactly why it worded this way. I don't know what was in God's mind. I just do not know. But whatever it was, it caused a reaction in Moses that is amazing. Moses says, you are the savior of this people. You want to start over with just me, sort of like you did with Noah? God, that's not like you. And I almost think God was saying it just to make really sure that Moses understood that. Because in the end, God said, okay, you continue to lead them. I'll still be with you. And off they went. This was the big crisis. This was the big crisis during that 40-year period. This is the turning point that allowed those people who could have gone to the promised land to be told, no, you die out in the wilderness. And they wandered for 38 more years. Numbers chapter 20. Oh, one more thing before we leave. Chapter 14, verse 32. Verse 31, your children who you said would be seized as booty, they will be the ones whom I shall bring in, so they will get to know the country you disdained. As for you, your dead bodies will fall in this desert, and your children will be nomads in this country, in this desert for 40 years. Verse 34, for 40 days your spies reconnoitered the country. Each day will count as a year. 40 years you will bear the consequences of your guilt, and you will learn what it means to reject me. It's interesting, 40 days of spying, 40 years of wandering. Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20 is when Moses finds out he's not going to go into the promised land. Now, you got to stay with me, and if you weren't here last week, you're going to have somebody else help you. But if you'll take a look at Numbers chapter 20, the Israelites, the whole community, verse 1, arrived in the first month at the desert of Zin. My translation says, other translation says the desert of Sin. Interesting word. They settled at a certain place. Miriam, that was Aaron and Moses' sister, died and was buried there. Verse 2, what does it say? No water. All right, those of you who were here last week, or those of you who saw this as you read through Exodus and Leviticus, do you remember where the people got water? And do you remember where the people got food? The food was what?
Manna.
That's why they were hungry for meat. They hadn't had meat. They'd just been having manna. And where did they get water?
Rock.
From the rock. And how did the water come? He struck the rock, and the water would come. Right? Okay. See if you can listen carefully to this next part. There was no water for the community, so they banded together against Moses and Aaron, and they laid the blame on Moses. We would rather have died, they said, as our brothers died before the Lord. Why have you brought the Lord's community into this desert for us and our livestock to die here? Why did you lead us out of Egypt, if only to bring us to this wretched place? It's not a place fit for sowing. It has no figs, no vines, no pomegranates. There's not even water to drink. Moses and Aaron went to the entrance of the temple of the meeting, threw themselves on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord then spoke to Moses and said, take the branch. I'll tell you, the branch was when they were trying to let the community see God's choice to be priests. They cut branches off of a tree, and they assigned branches to various tribes. And there was one branch that continued to grow. And eventually that branch that continued to grow pointed to Aaron. So it's called Aaron's branch. They said, take the branch, call the community together, you and your brother Aaron, and in full view of them, order this rock to release its water. You will release water from the rock for them and provide drink for the community and their livestock. How was he to do it? Speak to the rock. How did he do it? Can you read verse 11, verse 12? Shall we make water gush from this rock for you? The tail end of verse 10 says, Moses raised his hand and struck the rock twice with his branch. Verse 12, God said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe that I could assert my holiness before their eyes, you will not lead this assembly into the country I'm giving them. And Moses and Aaron were not allowed to go in. How many times? I'm sorry, let's go back. If you weren't here last week, this is review, but if you weren't here last week, this is new. What did the rock represent? Uh-oh. Jesus Christ. You go to 1 Corinthians, it says the rock that followed them was Jesus. I do not know what that all means. How many times was Jesus crucified? Once. Strike the rock once. Water will come, and once is all you ever need to do. After that, speak. And he didn't speak. He struck again. And God says, nope, that's not the right way. And for that, Moses was not allowed to go into the promised land. Instead, a substitute was found. And the substitute was Joshua, assisted by Caleb. Those were the two spies who had originally said, we can do it, God is with us. Those were the two that were allowed to live. Numbers 21. Verse 4, they left Mount Hor by the road to the Sea of Suf to skirt around Edom. Edom, by the way, is the land where Jacob's brother Esau, his descendants were living there. On the way, the people lost patience. Are you noticing how many times the people lose patience? Are you picking up on that? Okay. Why did you bring us out here and die in the desert? There's neither food nor water here. We're sick of this meager diet. What's their meager diet? Manna and water from the rock. At this, God sent fiery serpents among the people. Their bite brought death to many in Israel. People came and said to Moses, we have sinned by speaking against the Lord, and you intercede for us with the Lord to save us from these serpents. And Moses did. And the Lord replied, make a fiery serpent and raise it as a standard. Anyone who is bitten and looks at it will survive. Moses then made a serpent out of bronze and raised it as a standard. And anyone who is bitten by a serpent and looked at the bronze serpent survived. John chapter 3. John chapter 3. Nearly everybody knows 3:16. Not everybody knows the verses right before. John chapter 3. Verse 14. Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, so that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. For this is how God loved the world. He gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but may have everlasting life. One of the greatest verses in the Old Testament is directly connected to this little piece of the Old Testament story. Make sure you see that on the way by. Numbers 22. Numbers 22, 23, 24, 25. There's so much in here that's interesting that I'm tempted to take the rest of the time, but I can't. We haven't even done Deuteronomy yet. And time is flying, so let's see what we can do. In this particular story, there's a prophet by the name of Balaam. And a king who doesn't want to be thrown out of the promised land, who doesn't want to have his kingdom overrun and all his people killed, comes to Balaam and offers him a big pile of money if he'll curse the people for him. And Balaam says, well, tell you what, I can't do anything if God doesn't let me do it. Let me check with God. Maybe he'll let me curse the people. And he goes and checks with God, and God says no. And he comes back and tells the guy, sorry, I can't do that. Man offers him more money. The king offers him more money. He goes back to God and says, hey, listen, he's offered me more money. You think I could curse the people now? And God says, no. And he goes back and tells the king, listen, I'm sorry. God says no, but, you know, let's see if we can't figure out a way. Now, this is obscure, but there's so many references to this in the New Testament. It's important to just at least see what the story says. Read through it. But here's the essence when you look through it through the lens of the New Testament. Here's the essence. Balaam was a prophet who taught non-believers how to make believers compromise. And the outcome of that was that Israel suffered, and suffered terribly. And in the New Testament, in several places, especially in those letters to the churches in Revelation, if some of you know about that, there's a place that says, you know, you're acting a lot like Balaam. You're compromising with the world and you're trying to teach everybody around how to do it. And it comes out of this story. Now, there's more in the story. This is the one place in the Bible where you run into talking donkeys. And I'll leave you to discover that piece. But when you look at the larger picture, that becomes a minor part. Numbers 26 is the second census beginning. You'll see more of that. I thought it was 32, but it's not. It's Numbers 26. Let me take you to Numbers 28. There's two places in the Bible. The other one is Leviticus 23. This one is clearer. Evangelical Christians, I'm one, and this church, this is where the members of this church are for the most part that. We have a belief that we are not called to practice the sacrificial system in the Old Testament. But I want you to look carefully at Numbers 28 and notice the larger message God is sending His people. He is telling them, here is when you sacrifice to me. I would turn that to say, here is when you think about me. Here is when you remember me. Here is when you begin to work on keeping the relationship between me and yourselves strong. Follow with me. Verse 4. What's the first couple of words? My translation says, every day. Does yours say something like that? Chapter 28, Numbers, verse 4. Okay. Each morning, each night, I'm summarizing that, every day, this is what you do. Turn to verse 9. What does it say? It says once a week. Every Sabbath, do this. What's that? Once a week. Verse 11. What does it say? Every month. Here's what you do. What's the picture so far? Every day, you do some things to remember who God is. Once a week, you do something more. Once a month, you do something more. And once a year, you do verse 16, verse 26, chapter 29, verse 1, chapter 29, verse 7, chapter 29, verse 12. Once a year, you do this. Once a year, you do this. Once a year. Look at the picture. Once a day, or maybe twice a day. Every day, you do this to remember me and to keep our relationship strong. Once a week, you also do this. Once a month, you also do this. And once a year, you do this, you do this, you do this. What were the great pieces of the Jewish year? Those once a year things. Passover was one. And remember, Jesus' crucifixion came in on top of that, giving added meaning to the symbolism of the Passover. Okay? Yom Kippur is another. That's Leviticus 16, Leviticus 17. That's the goat being sent out. That was that great day. and there's a couple of others in here. You'll hear it referred to in the New Testament as the Feast of Shelters, the Feast of Booths, things like that. These are the things they do every year. I like the picture that's there. Every day, every week do this more. Every month do this in addition. Every year do this in addition. Every year do this. I think that's a beautiful picture. From Numbers 32, from Numbers 33 and on, it talks quickly about how they came up to the land, and it talks about how they were going to divide the land among the people. If you look at the division of the land that was coming, you may notice in there that chapter 34, verse 23, the tribe of Joseph ends up with two portions of the land, one for Manasseh, one for Ephraim. That's the one we talked about. You'll notice there's not a portion for Levi, because Levi is supposed to spread out so that people will have someone leading them in worship wherever they live. There's more, but that's all we have time for. Can we move to Deuteronomy? I teach chemistry in my other life. And one of the things we talk about from time to time is deuterium. Deuterium is a second form of hydrogen, and its name gives away the word. Deutero means the second of something. Deuteronomy then means what? The second of something. Specifically, it means the second giving of the law. The law was given on the mountain, on Mount Sinai, when God came down and spoke the Ten Commandments. The law was given. All of those people are gone except for Caleb and Joshua. Who's left? The children. There is a second giving of the law to the children. And the whole book of Deuteronomy is focused on that. It's also telling you the end of Moses' life. So there are places where Moses summarizes things he's learned in his life. Summarizes things he wants the people to remember. Okay? So, the essence of this is the giving of the law. Moses starts early in Deuteronomy with a history lesson. He tells them what has happened on their journey. And as he does that, he uses very interesting language. He says, you experienced this, you experienced this, you experienced this, but those were all children who weren't there. So what does he mean when he says, you experienced this, you experienced this? In our ancestors, we have experienced things that they have passed on to us. If we can internalize them, they come alive. That's something of what he's saying. And it's really interesting how he says that. I don't know that I understand all of that. I just invite you to watch for that language. He doesn't say, your parents experienced this, your parents experienced that. He says, you did, you did, you did. One of the hardest things is to pass faith from one generation to another. And the book of Deuteronomy, almost as much as anything, is talking about how that was done that first time. He gives this for a long time. And I'll let you work your way through that. But I want you to show you the second thing. Now, at this moment, it's going to help you if you think for a moment about going to a concert by a symphony orchestra. Ever been lucky enough to go to a concert by a symphony orchestra? Have you ever heard them start out softly? One piece, maybe the oboe, maybe a solo violin, plays a melody. And it's beautiful. Just one little line is played. And then as it goes along, a second instrument joins. And then a third, and then a fourth. And the richness of the text of the music comes alive. Okay? What's the big message here? The law is being given the second time. What's the second message? Your children need to get their faith. Not have your faith. They need their own faith. That faith needs to be transmitted and replanted, and it needs to grow anew in your children. What's the third message? The third message that runs through Deuteronomy is Moses tells them, and he tells them again. And he tells them again. He must tell them 15 times if he tells them once. If you see somebody like Moses telling somebody the same thing 15 times, 20 times, what conclusion might you reach? This is something really important. And second, I'm pretty sure some of you are going to have trouble remembering this. And here's what it says. In essence, Joshua himself quotes it in the book of Joshua. We will see that tonight, I hope, if I can remember where it is when the time comes. He says to them, I am putting before you life and death. I'm putting before you blessings and curses. I'm putting before you promise and terror. You got to choose. And over and over, he says, if you follow God's commands, if you do His ways, if you're obedient to His law and His will, this good series of things will happen to you and your descendants. And if you do not, the things that are going to happen are things that you don't want to happen to your worst enemy. And you got to choose. You got to choose. You got to choose. 15, 20 times, I don't know how many times, but you walk through Deuteronomy, you cannot help but see that. And if you see that drumbeat over and over, that's one of the big themes of this book. Let me show you an example. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. You know, if I'm going to do this, I got to do one more thing. I was going to start at verse 7, but we got to start at verse 6. Okay, we got to start at verse 6. If I don't start at verse 6, then a month from now or 2 months from now, I can't do something in Samuel that I want to be able to do. When we get to 1 Samuel, you need to remember this verse. Okay, Deuteronomy 7, verse 6. You are a people consecrated to the Lord your God. Of all the peoples on earth, you have been chosen by the Lord your God to be His own people. Message, you are not to be like anybody else on earth. You are unique and special. In 1 Samuel, you are going to hear the people say, we want to have a king so that we can be just like everybody else on earth. And when you hear that, what do you hear? You hear, they didn't listen in Deuteronomy. And the things that are coming are going to be awful. Who is to be their king? God is. And that verse, I almost skipped it. That verse is way too important to skip. Verse 7, this is where I was going to go originally. The Lord set His heart on you and chose you. Now notice, that's a continuation of that verse 6. The Lord set His heart on you and He chose you. Why did He do that? Well, here's why. Because He didn't do it because you were the most numerous of all people, for you were one of the smallest nations around. It was because He loved you. And He meant to keep the oath which He swore to your ancestors. Way back there was Abraham. Way back there was Isaac. Way back there was Jacob. Way back there was Joseph and his brothers. And God made a promise to them. He didn't love you because you were the most numerous. It was He loved you because He made an oath to your ancestors. Listen to these ordinances then, verse 12 says. Be true to them and observe them, and in return the Lord your God will be true to the covenant and the love which He promised on earth to your ancestors. Chapter 8. You must keep and put into practice all the commandments which I enjoin on you today, so that you may survive and increase in numbers, and enter the country which the Lord promised on oath to your ancestors, and make it your own. Remember, the people are right on the edge. They've not entered yet. They will enter with Joshua when that book starts. Remember the long road by which the Lord your God led you for 40 years in the desert, to humble you, to test you, and to know your inmost heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. He humbled you. He made you feel hunger. He fed you with manna which neither you nor your ancestors had ever known, to make you understand that human beings do not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes out of the mouth of the Lord. The clothes on your back did not wear out. Your feet were not swollen all those 40 years. Learn from this that the Lord your God was training you as a man trains his child, and keep the commandments of the Lord your God, and so follow His ways and fear Him. Verse 11, Be careful not to forget the Lord your God by neglecting His commandments, customs, and laws, which I'm laying down for you today. When you've eaten all you want, when you've built fine houses to live in, when you've seen your flocks and herds increase, your silver and gold abound, and all your possessions grow great, do not become proud of heart. Do not then forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, that place of slave labor, who guided you through this vast and dreadful desert. Verse 17. Beware of thinking to yourself, my own strength and the might of my own hand have given me the power to act like this. Remember the Lord your God. He was the one who gave you the strength to act effectively like this, thus keeping today, keeping then as today, the covenant which he swore to your ancestors. Be sure, here comes the warning, if you forget the Lord your God, if you follow other gods, if you serve them and bow down to them, I testify to you today, you will perish. There's an old, old movie. It's called Shenandoah, and it starred Jimmy Stewart. And have you seen that?
Yes.
Early in the movie, they sit down to eat a meal, and Jimmy Stewart leads the prayer. You remember that prayer? God, we went out and worked in the fields. We did all the labor necessary to raise this food. But if you had anything to do with it, well, thank you. And then they went on with their meal. It's an amazing prayer that Hollywood put down in front of us. Okay. Chapter 30. How many chapters did I just skip? Yeah, I'm looking at the clock. I skipped 20. Verse 15, chapter 30. Look, today I'm offering you life and prosperity, and I'm offering you death and disaster. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I'm laying down for you today, if you love the Lord your God and follow his ways, keep his commandments, his laws and customs, you will live and grow numerous. And the Lord will bless you in the country to which you are about to enter and make your own. But if your heart turns away, if you refuse to listen, if you let yourself be drawn into worshiping other gods and serve them, I tell you today you will most certainly perish. You will not live for long in the country to which you're crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. Today I call heaven and earth to witness against you. I am offering you life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life then, so that you and your descendants may live in the love of the Lord your God, obeying his voice, holding fast to him, for in this your life consists. That's the book of Deuteronomy. There's way more, but that's the essence of it. Joshua. Oops. I'm glad I wrote notes. I got to go back and do one more little thing. Would you go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 18? I knew there was something in there that I didn't want to skip. There it is. Moses has been praying to God about something really important. And the Lord gives something for Moses to say to the people. Now, I want to make sure you see it. I want you to see one of the pieces that's in this. Verse 13 of Deuteronomy 18. Deuteronomy 18, verse 13. You, this is God, Moses speaking to the people, you must be faultless in your relationship with the Lord your God. For these nations whom you are going to dispossess have listened to soothsayers and mediums. But the Lord your God does not permit you to do this. There's one point where a king of Israel consults a soothsayer, and it's this verse that they're violating. Here it comes. For from among yourselves, from among your own brothers, I'm at verse 15 now, the Lord your God will raise up a prophet like me. You will listen to him. This is exactly what you asked the Lord your God to do at Horeb on the day of assembly, when you said, never let me hear the voice of God again. Instead, let God put somebody that can speak to me and tell me what God says. What the people said is well said, God said to me. From their own brothers, I will raise up a prophet like yourself. I will put my words into his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. Anyone who refuses to listen to my words spoken by him in my name will have to render an account to me. But the prophet who presumes to say something in my name which I have not commanded him to say, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet must die. Who is this person Moses is foretelling? That's Jesus. From among you, from among your brothers, he's going to raise up a prophet like me. And you better listen to him. You need to listen to him. Now, look at verse 21. This is the little coda that has great importance. You may be privately wondering, how in the world are we supposed to tell if a prophecy comes from the Lord? There are two answers to that. Here's the first one. When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord and the thing does not happen and the word is not fulfilled, then it has not been said by God, and the prophet has spoken presumptuously, you have nothing to fear from him. That's test one for a prophet. But that isn't the end of the test. The second half of the test is in Deuteronomy 13. So turn to Deuteronomy 13. I'd like to look at verse 1. Deuteronomy 13, verse 1. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you, offering some sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder comes about, what has just happened? He's passed test 1. If he then says to you, let us follow other gods hitherto unknown to you and serve them, you must not listen to that prophet's words or to that dreamer's dreams. The Lord your God is testing you to know if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. The Lord your God is the one you must follow. Him you must fear. His commandments you must keep. His voice you must obey. Him you must serve. To him you must hold fast. What's test 2? Even if somebody comes and sounds so good and everything they say in terms of prophecy comes true, if their next step is to tell you, oh, let's go this way, when everything you know about God says you need to be going this way, that's a person you better really be concerned about. That is a danger. And that's a bigger danger than the first one. Sweet-sounding people who say everything right and then take you and lead you by the nose in some new direction. And a church has to be tough to stand up against that if a new leader comes. And a people has to be tough to stand up against that when the leader sounds so good and sounds so right. There's two tests for prophets. Do they speak presumptuously? And do they lead the people in the right direction? What's the obligation on me? What's the obligation on you? We better have some sense of where God is leading us, because if somebody's leading us some other way, we're supposed to know that that's the wrong way and this is the right way. That means we can't just be blasé and say, well, if the leader says we go this way, that's what we do. That's a pretty tough thing, and I want to make sure you see that as you go by. Joshua, we have 7 minutes, and we have how many chapters? 24 chapters. That's about 3 chapters a minute. Maybe we can do this. Maybe we can do this. Can I show you something in Joshua 3 first? What do the people have to do to get into the promised land? They got to cross the Jordan River. Chapter 3, verse 14. When the people left their tents to cross the Jordan, the priests carried the Ark of the Covenant ahead of the people, and as soon as the bearers of the Ark reached the Jordan and the feet of the priest carrying the Ark touched the waters, the Jordan is in full flood through the harvest season. The upper waters stood still and formed a single mass over a great distance. It tells you where. The people crossed opposite Jericho. The priests carried the Ark of the Covenant. They stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the river while all of Israel crossed on dry ground. They didn't cross on mud, folks. They crossed on dry ground. What do you see? The same thing Moses did in crossing the Red Sea, Joshua is able to do. God is giving the people a sign. This is my leader. And he's doing things Moses did. Okay? Joshua chapter 1. Let's back up for just a minute. Joshua chapter 1. Verse 1, when Moses, the servant of the Lord, was dead, the Lord spoke to Joshua. Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' adjutant. And he said, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now go and cross the Jordan, you and this whole people. Verse 5, as long as you live, no one will be able to resist you. And here's the powerful phrase, I will be with you just as I was with Moses. I will not fail you. I will not desert you. Joshua gets the same promise as Moses. Joshua gets some of the same power as Moses. The mantle of leadership has passed on. Okay? Couple more things, just for what it's worth. Chapter 2, the first big city they have to take, in fact, the key to the whole section was Jericho. And when they took Jericho, the will of the people beyond to resist them just sort of crumbled. And Jericho was an awful place to try to take. He sent spies into Jericho, just like they had sent spies into the Promised Land, sent spies into Jericho. And they almost caught them. But they ended up in a brothel with a prostitute protecting them. Later on, you're going to get bored as the dickens reading the genealogies. But don't. Watch closely, because that prostitute shows up as one of Jesus' ancestors. You keep watching a little closer, and you find out it's one of David's great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents. Kind of cool. Joshua chapter 5. Joshua chapter 5. I find this one fascinating. Verse 13. Joshua near Jericho. Jericho hasn't come yet. Joshua was near Jericho. He looked up and saw a man standing in front of him, grasping or holding a drawn sword. Now, if you're a warrior coming in to take over a country, you're leading the army, you're out by yourself, and all of a sudden there's a soldier in front of you, a man in front of you, and he's got a drawn sword, what's the first thing that's going to come to your mind? I might be about to die. So he asks him a question. Joshua walked toward him and said, "Are you on our side, or are you on the side of our enemies?" And what does the man reply?
Neither
side. I find that one of the most remarkable sentences in the Old Testament. Keep reading. "I have come as the captain of the army of the Lord." Joshua fell down on his face to the ground, worshiping this man, and said, "What has my Lord to say to his servants?" And the captain of the army of the Lord answered Joshua, "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy ground." Have you heard that phrase before? Who said it? God said it. Who to? Moses at the burning bush. Who's this person? Angels in the New Testament, when John goes to worship the angel who's taking him around in Revelation, he tries to worship him, and the angel says, "Don't you do that. The only one you worship is God. This person is accepting worship. Who is this?" This is God in human form on the earth. Who's that? Commentators who look at this, and I think who look at this fairly, say this is Jesus before his incarnation. This is the pre-incarnate Jesus. And if you keep an eye out about five times in the Old Testament, you'll spot that. How did we start in January? Do you remember the first thing I read to you? It's over in the book of Luke. A couple of people on their way to Emmaus. And at the end of that story, Jesus says, "You know, you haven't figured out a thing about what's been happening in Jerusalem last week. He had just been crucified. He had just died. He's been resurrected." He says to them, "You haven't understood anything." And starting with Moses, that's the five books of the law, and going through all the prophets, that's those 17 books at the end. The Old Testament was all the Bible that they knew in that day. He showed to them all the passages that were about himself. I think this is one he showed them. I love the phrase, "Whose side are you on?" You heard the people say, "No way anybody could be Christian and be a Democrat." There's Democrats who say, "No way anybody could be Christian and be a Republican." Which side is God on? I want to be real careful how I say that. There's a whole lot each group is doing that I just find repugnant. But I think at the end of the day, God's going to say, I'm on a side that nobody's finding. I'm not on either of those two sides. And even here, which side are you on? I'm on neither side. I think we have to take that seriously, and I want to make sure you see it. Okay, chapter 8. We are almost out of time. I'm now in overtime, and I've got 1 minute. Okay. No, I don't have time to do it right. I'll simply tell you, if you go through the rest of this book, what you find is the destruction of the people in the Promised Land. And this looks awful to the modern eye. I heard somebody say one time, here's a way to look at it. I don't know if this is the right way to look at it. I simply offer it to you. What happened to the people there, the New Testament said, was a lesson for us to learn from. Physical models of heavenly or spiritual realities, right? We've been talking about that. The entering of the Promised Land and the cleansing out of the people in front of them sounds to our ears like genocide. And I don't know how to reconcile that feeling. I share it. But I heard somebody say, what happens when the Spirit comes into my heart, all full of sin? What does it have to do? It has to root it out. And it has to be ruthless in the process, because if you ever compromise with it, and they do, That's part of the story of Joshua. Read it. When they compromise with it, then the problems follow them for years. Follow them forever. Because you've left a foothold for sin in the heart. There's something ruthless about the Spirit rooting out sin in my heart. Maybe that's what the message is here. If there is a better message, I've not heard it yet. Now, they have entered the land. They have settled the land. Everything is done. The first book of Judges comes. The book of Judges follows. And I want to read one verse in that book. It's the saddest verse in this section. And it echoes something that happened way back in Egypt. Joseph died. He had saved Egypt as well as his own people. But a king arose who didn't know Jesus, Joseph, and all kinds of things happened that were bad. Here's Judges chapter 2, verse 10. When that whole generation had been gathered to its ancestors, the ones who had entered the promised land, another generation followed it, which neither knew the Lord nor the deeds which he had done for their sake in Israel. And the book of Judges is a book of the misery that comes when you do that. The book of Deuteronomy, how do we transmit our faith to where it becomes our children's faith? How do you do that? And how do you keep doing that? What happens in Judges is a story of they had it all and they blew it. And why did they blow it? Because they didn't remember any of that. They didn't know the Lord. They didn't know anything about what he had done. Generation that arises that doesn't know the Lord and doesn't remember what he's done, that generation is in deep trouble. That's all we have time for. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, I thank you for the time you give us, and I thank you for this time. I pray that some of the things that have been said tonight will make your word come alive in the hearts of these good people and in others who will hear of this as time goes by. I pray that you would bless the reading of your word to where people who are reading your word will find in it things to keep them engaged and to bring them closer to you through their study. You say that when we look at your word, it will bring us closer to you, and I claim that promise for us who are gathered here in this place. Go with us through the week to come, through the month to come, and keep us safe so that we may regather as we move forward in this process. We ask all this in your Son's name.